Oh my God, I was reading one of them Shakespeare plays the other day, and oh my life, mate. I mean, they are absolutely filthy, mate. I mean, honestly, if you want to read some serious pornography, then Shakespeare plays, I mean, that is the way forward. And then my mate, right, he got hold of some Geoffrey Chaucer, Canterbury Tales. Oh my life, mate. I mean, that is absolutely filthy. I mean, seriously, you should go for it. And after I read that, I was so up for it. I went out and I found myself a prostitute. I didn't care that she had the clap. I just went for it, mate. And oh my life, mate, it is fantastic living in the mid 18th century. Absolutely unacceptable, disgusting and revolting. What kind of people were they in the 18th century? I mean, we have to censor these Shakespeare plays. I mean, one's wives and one's servants might read Shakespeare plays. I mean, would Shakespeare plays really be the kind of thing you would want your wives and your servants to read in their current form? I, for one, am glad that Mr. Boulder has produced an edition that is suitable for one's wives, one's children's, and one's servants. And one's servants' children, so that they could enjoy Shakespeare, our bard, without the elements that perhaps you would regard as less than entirely acceptable in our modern Victorian enlightened era. Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of The Jolly Heretic. Now, today I'd like to talk about something which I've been thinking about for quite a while, and that is basically, why is it that the Victorians were so puritanical? Why is it that they were so conservative? We often have this idea that as history moves forward, people become more liberal, more left-wing. But that really is not necessarily the case at all. First of all, there are cycles, and I'll look at those cycles later. But secondly, the Victorian era, the 19th century, really was a period of intense conservatism compared to what preceded it. And why was this the case? But before we look into that, a quick word from our sponsor. Well, first, a word from our sponsor. Now, we are all truth seekers here at the Jolly Heretic Public House, but here's the problem, chaps. We can only get to the truth if we have multiple perspectives, if we have multiple interpretations, if we have access to the other side, if we have access to all viewpoints. Only then can we really understand what's going on in the world, and we are increasingly finding that we cannot do that. Information is blocked, websites are blocked, alternative perspectives are blocked, and so the only way round this, realistically, is some form of VPN. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN gives you everything you can possibly need. There is currently a Steel Black Friday deal going on in which you can get Atlas VPN Premium for just $1.70 per month plus 6 months extra with a 30-day money-back guarantee. This is the best VPN offer Atlas have ever done, and it's a time-limited offer, so it's time to get on with it, chaps. It has all kinds of benefits to Atlas VPN. There's this brilliant offer. You can unlock your favourite content from all over the world. If you can't access your favourite program or whatever, your Atlas VPN has got you covered. You can keep your Google searches secret and private using Atlas VPN. You can stop ads and malware. You can save money online. It will give you get you the best deals while shopping online, and it will all that kind of stuff. And you can protect unlimited devices using Atlas VPN. As I say, there is a fantastic offer on at the moment, in which it's just $1.70 a month plus 6 months extra with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So this really is the cheapest and best way to get a VPN. We increasingly need VPNs. The truth is blocked. The truth is covered up. We can't get access to information. And in a society that's doing this to us, we need a VPN. And as far as I can see, Atlas VPN is where it's at, chaps. Right, back to the video. So why were they... I mean, and they definitely were highly conservative in terms of... In numerous ways. Women's dresses changed, such that in the Georgian period, of course, there would be cleavage revealed. This completely changed. Up comes the dress line so that nothing is revealed. Women go from exposing their hair or wearing wigs to wearing hats and scarves and covering up their hair. There is what's called the bauderization of Shakespeare and Chaucer and other texts. so that you, because of sexuality was much more openly discussed in Chaucer and in Shakespeare and whatever than was the case in the Victorian era. And so in the same way that they are censoring a Victorian literature now for racism and whatever, there was a guy called Balder who produced censored editions of Shakespeare and Chaucer and so on that could so that the sensitivities of the 19th century could cope with it. You had a constant morality campaigns emanating from the middle classes about issues such as drunkenness and sexual morality and all of that sort of thing. Racism is an interesting one. So in the 18th century, it's not that there wasn't racism. It's not that it was completely acceptable to engage in, let's say, a mixed race relationship, but it was much more acceptable than it was in the 19th century. And you had many cases of in the 18th century of people in India, upper class people or whatever, that would have relationships with the local Indian women and would have children, and that was absolutely fine. By the time we get into the 19th century, this is increasingly unacceptable, and there is not to be fraternization between the natives and the English. Similarly with social class, social class differences become much clearer and much more based around morality. So you if you go back further in history, you have people marrying people of different social classes, women marrying up and all this sort of thing. This starts to change in the 19th century, and there's very much this view that social classes are almost like separate castes. And they are not to mix. Illegitimacy becomes increasingly unacceptable. English kings, right up until William IV, had had illegitimate children, and William IV's illegitimate children were hanging around at court, and Queen Victoria banished them from court, and illegitimacy became increasingly unacceptable across the 19th century, to the extent that by the beginning of the 20th century, it was so unacceptable that you'd have middle-class women, secretaries or whatever, that become pregnant by their bosses, and they would put their kids up for adoption rather than have them, because illegitimacy was so unacceptable and so shameful. Sexuality became more and more and more taboo and unable to be discussed. But what was going on? Why was it that Victorian England was so much more conservative? Well, there are a number of reasons for this. And I will build up into what I regard as from the least significant to the most significant. So the first is simply a normal process that always happens, which is a conservative reaction against extreme liberalism. As I've looked at before, we as humans have five moral foundations that reflect the fact that we are a pack animal that competes against other packs, other groups, but also that we are individuals that must compete to attain status within our own group, not least because in harsh Darwinian conditions it was those that had higher status that were more likely to have more surviving offspring and therefore pass on their genes. So you have the group-oriented foundations. These are obedience to authority, that you are loyal to the group, in-group loyalty, and disgust versus sanctity. So the disgust is an issue basically of keeping away from things which are bad for you and which will make you sick, and using the process of sanctity and what is holy and what is taboo to render unquestionable that which is good for you and that which is good for the group. And then you have the individually oriented foundations. This is equality, that everyone has to have an equal share of everything, and harm avoidance, which is at the individual level that you try to avoid harm. Now, it's been found by Jonathan Haidt that conservatives are about the same in all five moral foundations. They value all five moral foundations equally, though extreme conservatives will value only the individualising foundations and they won't care so much about harm or equality. Now, by contrast, liberals care only about equality and harm avoidance, and they don't really care about the group-oriented foundations. So liberals are individualists. Now, I've looked at why this is the case. Liberals are, they're out for themselves. How do you achieve status? Well, one way is covertly. How do you covertly achieve status? Where do you go on about equality and looking like equality is important? You go on about harm avoidance, about seeming nice, and this is a way, without evoking conflict, of subtly achieving status. And so this is why people that are individually oriented will tend to engage in this practice, and it is why it's been found that the liberal does not identify with his close people that are closely related to him, such as his ethnic group or whatever. He identifies with those that are more distant from him. It allows him to collaborate in his individual interests to get status in his own group. Now, what you get then is a situation of asymmetrical empathy, whereby the conservative can sympathise with the liberal's ideas because he values those as well, but the liberal cannot sympathise with the conservative ideas. The result is that the liberal will be able to successfully take control of culture and move it in an increasingly left-wing liberal direction. And he will do this until you reach a situation where there is an evolutionary mismatch, where there is dysphoria, where there is chaos. Because one of the things that is associated with conservatism is order. If I had to really simplify it, I say conservatism is essentially about order. All of these moral foundations that relate to them are about order. Obedience to authority, and the liberals, it's about fairness and equality and whatever. So you get to a situation where it's so disordered that there is chaos, and then you get a conservative backlash. So you could argue that there was a degree to which 18th century England was disordered. It created an evolutionary mismatch. It was so decadent, and the result of that was the backlash of conservatism in the 19th century. So that's the first reason. But I think that it goes a lot deeper than that. There's a lot more to it than that. The second is the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution hits in really sort of 1750 to 1800. Now, what does this result in? Well, what you have is an unbelievable and very rapid amount of change. As I've looked at our wit's end, why we're becoming less intelligent, what it means for the future. The change that you would have noticed if you were born in 1750 and died in 1850, or whatever, would have been absolutely, or born in 1800, where we were still basically agrarian, and died in 1900, would have been absolutely unbelievable. So you have rapid pace of change. Now, what rapid pace of change does is it causes people to cope with the uncertainty by becoming more religious. Now, religiousness itself, belief in God, belief in a God watching you, it crosses over very strongly with group orientation. The two are strongly connected. It's even been found that if you stimulate a certain part of the brain with magnets, you become both more positively and negatively ethnocentric and more religious, because the two have been concomitantly selected for. They cross over with each other. Religiousness tends to take that which is adaptive and make it into the will of God or gods. That's what religiousness is. And what is adaptive to a certain extent is group orientation. And the five moral foundations. And so the result is that you become essentially more conservative if you become more religious, at least at that time. The religiousness is a conservative religiosity. So it elevates religiousness, and therefore it elevates the conservatism that is associated with religiousness. The second reason is that what the Industrial Revolution does is it uproots communities. It changes everything in often quite a negative way. People go from having a sense of who they are and knowing who they are to being plunged into this new environment or into this new country or this new city or whatever, and they have this just sense of chaos, and it's unfair, and they're kind of excluded. Suddenly they find they've gone from being reasonably important members of a village to being unimportant people that work in a factory. There's this sense of exclusion. That's another thing which alienation, if you like. That's another thing which elevates religiousness. People that have a feeling of being alienated, people that have a feeling of being excluded from power or whatever. Those people tend to be more religious. And so the sense in which the Industrial Revolution, by changing people's lives in this rapid way, kind of does this. And so it disempowers people, if you like. And so they react to this by becoming more religious. And so you get in these mining towns in Wales, you know, the rise of Methodism and all of that sort of thing. And this is a conservative form of religiosity. Even more important than this, though, is what it does in terms of disease, what it does in terms of sickness. Now, on the one hand, it can be argued that the Industrial Revolution, you might say, well, it makes people less sick, doesn't it? The Industrial Revolution results in the rise of better inoculations, of better healthcare. The result of that is that child mortality falls from 50% in 1800 to something like 10% by 1900 or 1880. That is true. So, but what you have then is, and the result of that is that the population increases. So that is true. But it kind of, in a sense, it gives with one hand and takes away with another. So yes, it eliminates things like smallpox, which were formerly killing lots of children and that sort of thing. And it brings in some vaccines, but it also results in an enormous rise in other diseases, often much more frightening diseases, which there is nothing they can do anything about until, in many cases, about 1950. And so this is going to have a very, very serious effect. What you have is an enormous movement of people that's going to that's over a long period, over long periods of time, that's going to spread disease. What you have is more and more people living in cities. What you have is more and more people desperate to live in cities. And so you have a rise in squalid living conditions, people living cheek by jowl in a case that was never previous in a way that was never previously the case. And so what you have then is an increase, a massive increase in diseases that people are already used to, but they increase tremendously and become far more significant and far more likely that you'll catch them, such as tuberculosis and typhus and venereal disease, and also a massively increased manifestation of diseases that the people simply aren't used to at all. Because there have been clean water sources, such as relatively clean water sources anyway, such as rivers, and these are now gone. And so you have a rise in a sense, new diseases that are actually very frightening. And an obvious example would be something like cholera. Cholera was practically unknown before the Industrial Revolution, because people were not living in the same squalid conditions. You didn't have things like cholera. Now, cholera is an extremely frightening illness. You catch cholera and you will shit and vomit yourself to death within a couple of hours. You literally, you'd be absolutely fine. You get cholera and within a couple of hours, you're dead. And they had no idea how it happened. They had no idea what caused it. So you can imagine this is extremely frightening. And you have more and more conditions like this that simply didn't exist before people were crammed into cities in large numbers. And you had an enormous rise in conditions that had been relatively rare before, such as tuberculosis and such as typhus. Now, that is going to make people much more conservative. There are studies that indicate that the higher is the level of parasite stress, pathogen stress, or whatever in a society, the more conservative and the more religious it tends to be. Now, why is this the case? Well, because if you're surrounded with lots of frightening diseases, first of all, you're surrounded with uncertainty. There is a tremendous uncertainty. People kind of knew that there was the child mortality was 50%, and people would just know, okay, yeah, is this child sickly or not? Oh, it's a bit sickly. Oh, it's not going to last very long. Oh, it's going to die. People would understand that. And once you got past, I don't know, 5 or something like that, then, which only about half of the population did, then there was a very good chance that you'd live quite a long time. Interestingly, there's data on this of the life expectancy at a certain age going down during the Industrial Revolution. Life expectancy literally declines during the Industrial Revolution to something like 17. So it's having a significant effect. People are growing up, surviving childhood, and then dying at young ages and dying quite suddenly. And that wasn't happening before. People would die in massive numbers when they were very young, and then they would toddle on until they were 50 or 60. Of course, there'd be exceptions to this. I mean, but you have people recorded in the 16th century dying at 100 or whatever. And suddenly you've got this new problem. So you've got uncertainty, that's going to elevate religiousness. You've got mortality salience, that's going to specifically elevate religiousness. Increase in disease. Now, what an increase in disease does is it elevates disgust. Disgust is one of the elements of the conservative personality traits. It's been found that if you induce disgust in somebody, then you make them more conservative. You make them, you know, more concerned about order and more concerned about sort of conservative things. People that are higher in disgust are more conservative, and conservatism crosses over very strongly with disgust, and also with just racism and general prejudice against strangers. People who are high in disgust are more prejudiced against strangers, and if you induce disgust in people, you make them more prejudiced against strangers. Now, why is this? Well, obviously, in a context of lots of disease that can kill you, you basically need to keep away from people. You need to avoid people. You need to avoid disease. And you will, on some level, understand that in an evolutionary sense, people are vectors of disease. And so, therefore, you need to keep away from people. Now, what's going to be the result of that? Well, we know that the general attitude of the Victorians, they didn't understand germs yet, was that disease happened because of a sort of miasma. Bad air, things like that. And it happened more to working class people. So basically working class people were vectors of disease. So you need to keep away from working class people. So you have this very strong sense in the 19th century of prejudice against the working class, of prejudice against the poor, which you didn't have earlier. If you go back to the 16th century, they practically intermingle. It wasn't a weird thing to have somebody who was gentry and they'd have a relatively close relative who was like lower middle class on the borders of the working class. It really wasn't unusual at all. What you get now in the 19th century is this clear separation into very distinct social classes, with them strongly looking down on people who are of a different social class and feeling that you really should keep away from people who are a different social class. And this is a way for the upper classes, essentially, to avoid disease. So you start to get this tremendous snobbery that is not seen, I think, if you go back to the 18th or 17th century, against people of lower social classes, this extreme snobbery against them. The idea that someone like Thomas Cromwell could rise from being a Putney blacksmith's son or Cardinal Wolsey, an Ipswich butcher's son, to being a member of the upper class. This was not kind of happening in the same way in the Victorian era because there was so much more class prejudice. You also get much more in the way of racial prejudice because you have to keep away from people. People who are from a different group, who are from somewhere else, they could have novel... If this high disease... salience, then they could have novel parasites that you're not used to, which could kill you. So it makes sense that you keep away from them. And what you want is control, and what you want is order, and what you want is to basically control people and keep away from other people. And this, of course, then has an impact on the issue of sex. You need to control your behaviour needs to be controlled. Who you're touching and how you're touching them. Who you're in contact with and how you're in contact with. Sex has an element of disgust and it evokes an element of disgust. It involves the exchange of bodily fluids and so on. And so this needs to be controlled. You need to control people. You need to control how they act. You need to control what they do. You need to control their sexuality. You need to, and you need to know the kind of people they are. Are they the kind of people that are controlled? And if they have illegitimate children, well, they're obviously not the kind of people that are controlled. And so they are a danger, and they could pick up diseases, and they could spread diseases to you and their children. There's an understanding that traits seem to be a bit sort of heritable to some extent, and that they could be like that. They could be stained with hereditary diseases and all this kind of thing. And they could make you ill and they could make you sick and you need to keep away from them. And that becomes the general ask, keep away from them. Don't go and play with the child who is illegitimate. Catherine Cookson, the English author, had this response. My mother says that we shouldn't play with you because you're a bastard, she was told at school. And that is a kind of response. A person is low in control, they might be sick and they might make you sick. And then this then fits in with the issue of venereal disease. Now, there had been the clap since about the 1400s. It was brought back from America, it seems. There had been venereal disease, gonorrhea and syphilis. And the original attitude towards it was, oh, it's God's punishment on people. Then it became, it's God's punishment on... When it was understood that it was spread by sex, it became that, oh, it's God's punishment kind of on the poor, but for rich people it's just a consequence of high living and it's okay for them to have syphilis. And now gradually what you have with the Victorians is an understanding that syphilis causes infertility in women, and also that syphilis is very, very high among people in the Navy and the Army. You have a this is fitting with the fact that the Victorians are highly intelligent and they're collecting statistics. And they have data on this, that it's very, very high, it's 40% or whatever, in the Army and the Navy. And therefore, that alone is a problem, because if the Army and the Navy have all got syphilis, then they might not be able to fight. And so, therefore, the country is doomed. And if it's causing infertility... then the country is doomed. So we've got to stop syphilis. So we've got to control sexuality. So, and therefore it all spreads from there. Sexuality needs to be controlled, and it needs to be controlled via religiosity and whatever, which is brought about via the disgust response to being surrounded by all of these new diseases all the time. So even though on some level Victorians are becoming healthier because they've got rid of certain kinds of disease and therefore there's more of them and there is less child mortality, on the other hand, there is higher mortality in terms of these new and extremely frightening diseases. And I think this is why there was this reaction, this conservative reaction across the 19th century. And in a mini way, you get something like that in the 1980s, perhaps. Attitudes to homosexuality were becoming more and more and more liberal until the 80s and the rise of AIDS, when suddenly homosexuality became considerably more socially unacceptable. And that was just in a kind of miniature because of AIDS, but that was in a miniature way. But this is in a major way. So I think that I think that solves pretty much the paradox of why it was that in the that we should be becoming more liberal across time, but in the 19th century we become way more conservative. I think the key thing is the rise everywhere. Imagine what it was like of these frightening diseases that we just simply can't control and couldn't control until basically the 50s. So keep your hands clean.
Hello. The Jolly Heretic is an online public house which meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss the kind of based, fearless science which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. If you would like to help the Jolly Heretic public house, and there are many ways you can do so, please become one of my patrons on Subscribestar. Also, if you want to, you can donate to the channel using Odyssey and Entropy, and you can also purchase Jolly Heretic merchandise such as shirts and mugs. All of the links are in the description. Again, I'd be most violently grateful if you could assist the Jolly Heretic Public House, and I will see you all soon, and goodbye!